Hello. Today we're going to talk to you about developments in the treatment of paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria. My name is Elizabeth Griffiths, and I practice at the Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center in Buffalo, New York. And my co-presenter is Dr. Eileen Weitz, who's a professor of clinical medicine at the Jane Ann Knoll Division of Hematology at the Keck School of Medicine at the University of Southern California. These are our disclosures. We're going to begin this session with a clinical case of a patient of mine. RJ was 19 years old at the time that he initially came to see us, and he was diagnosed with severe aplastic anemia in January of 2012. He demonstrated baseline pancytopenia with a white blood cell count of 2.9, an ANC of 0.2, and a hemoglobin of 7.5 grams, requiring transfusions of blood and platelets about twice a week. His baseline platelet count was less than 10. At the time of this CBC, his platelet count was 12,000. Unfortunately, no allogeneic bone marrow transplant donor was available for him, and so he received initial treatment with ATG and cyclosporin. 6 months later, after receiving this treatment, the patient demonstrated relative normalization of the hemogram. His white count had improved to 4.4, with a neutrophil count of 3.29. His hemoglobin was around 9 grams, and his platelets had fully recovered to 175,000. At the time of follow-up, he was noted to have an increase in his LDH up to 3,000. He was noted also to have reticulocytosis with an absolute reticulocyte count of 170,000. Based on these findings, PNH flow cytometry testing was performed on the peripheral blood and subsequently was found to be positive with multiple cell lineages demonstrating absence of GPI-anchored proteins with the percentages you can see here. Unfortunately, 1 week after his PNH test, which was not yet available to us, the patient presented with severe gastroenteritis with diarrhea, and labs showed an acute kidney injury with a creatinine rising up as high as 5.6 and a new profound anemia with a hemoglobin of 6 grams. Why was this patient so sick, and what caused his renal failure and hemoglobin drop? So PNH is an acquired disorder of clonal hematopoietic stem cells. In patients like ours, in the case, these GPI-anchored deficient stem cells can have a relative survival advantage in the context of an autoimmune-mediated attack on the bone marrow compartment. And after treatment, you can sometimes see expansion of such cells, resulting in clinical PNH. PNH cells acquire mutations in a gene called PIGA, or phosphatidyl inositol glycan A. These mutations result in a decreased presentation of protein on the cell surface as a result of loss of the GPI-anchored proteins. There are more than 100 GPI-anchored proteins that are presented in this way. PIGA mutant hematopoietic stem cells and their progeny lack surface complement inhibitors, including CD55, or decay accelerating factor, and CD59, membrane inhibitor of reactive lysis. And these complement deficient cells are lysed in circulation by complement. This lysis causes chronic intravascular hemolysis and hemoglobinuria, thrombocytopenia, because all of the progeny of the mutant PNH cells lack complement inhibitory proteins, and leukopenia. This also increases risk for thrombosis as a result of sequelae, which we'll describe in detail here. The bone marrow function results in leukopenia and thrombocytopenia, which can be seen in these patients. And again, as mentioned, these patients have substantial overlap with acquired aplastic anemia. GPI-anchored biosynthesis is actually a very complicated process, which involves more than 10 steps and more than 20 genes. You can see here that phosphatidyl inositol glycan A is initially prepared in the Golgi, and then subsequently, loss of this anchor results in loss of multiple types of different proteins, which are then no longer presented on the cell surface and can no longer inhibit complement. Under normal circumstances, complement inhibitory proteins are present on the surface of all cells, and these complement inhibitory proteins prevent the complement system from attacking endogenous cells or parts of our own cells, and instead allow complement to be targeted to bacterial invaders. You can see here that in the context of activated complement, the complement system results in formation of a membrane pore, which allows free flow of water intracellularly and causes cell lysis. So at this point, I'll transition over to Dr. Weitz, who will talk to us about what is complement.
So complement is a system of over 40 proteins in the blood and on cell surfaces that is part of our innate immune system. It helps us discriminate between abnormal tissues, cellular debris, apoptotic cells, or foreign intruders such as viruses or bacteria. It's a really critical part of our defense against microbacterial intruders. Excess activation, whether it's due to an immune process or an infection, can lead to additional immune complications. Inflammation can contribute to neurodegeneration, ischemia, and other age-related diseases. So the imbalance between activation and inhibition can lead to accelerated terminal complement, which can then cause additional tissue damage. We know that complement deficiencies can increase the susceptibility to infection. That's particularly true for C5 inhibition, which can affect meningococcal and Neisseria bacteria. C3 deficiencies can affect anything that's cleared through the spleen, through the splenic macrophage, including Haemophilus influenza, strep pneumonia, staph, etc. So alterations in complement function can then result in disease, such as PNH, autoimmune diseases, such as APLS, systemic lupus, thrombotic microangiopathies, transplant rejection, ischemia, neurodegenerative disorders, and age-related diseases, scleroderma, and cancer. So looking at the complement system, you can see that it's activated by three pathways: the classical pathway, antigen antibody, the lectin pathway through galactomannose, and the alternative pathway that acts as a bit of a priming system to allow the system to always be ready for upregulation if there's a need. They all converge on the generation of C3 convertase, which then converts C3, complement protein 3, to C3b and C3a. C3b is very important because there are receptors for C3b, and C3a is an inflammatory protein and also contributes to the activation of other cells. Two C3Bs and a BB fraction also act as the amplification arm of complement. So once you activate C3 to C3B, you generate bundles of C3B, which then serve as an enzyme that can activate C5. C5 is then cleaved to C5A and C5B. C5B fixes the terminal complement proteins that accomplishes the next function of complement, which is to punch a hole in the membrane. C5A is a very potent inflammatory protein, and it's also involved in chemotaxis. It activates our receptors on platelets, monocytes, and granulocytes, leading to activation of all these cells, contributing to the thrombogenicity. It also increases the inflammatory response by increasing TNF-alpha, IL-1-beta, and IL-6, which then can activate monocytes to generate more tissue factor. The terminal proteins then are activated and cause cell lysis. As you can see, complement affects multiple cellular cells, including endothelial cells, Bs and T cells, and K cells. But most important for PNH are the red cells, the platelets, and the neutrophils, which all have receptors for complement proteins. So how can we modulate the system? We can modulate the system by having a series of inhibitors that act as a lid so you don't generate too much complement and damage your own cells. And those include the membrane-bound inhibitors that we've talked about, CD55, as well as CD59 blocking the terminal proteins, terminal complement complex insertion into the membrane, and CD55 affecting the generation of C3b, inactivating C3b so that you can't then proceed on to C5 cleavage. There are circulating inhibitors, which are important in AHUS, for example, factor I, its cofactor factor H, and the membrane cofactor, as well as complement receptor 1, that modulates the amount of C3b on the cell.
In PNH, the consequence of complement activation can have disparate effects on multiple organ systems. Inappropriate complement activation in circulation results in amplification of complement and generation of the membrane attack complex, which actually causes direct lysis of red cells intravascularly. This releases free hemoglobin into circulation, which scavenges nitric oxide and produces vascular hyperreactivity. It also causes release of free hemoglobin, which is then filtered directly at the kidney and can cause renal hemosiderosis. The scavenged nitric oxide can cause pulmonary hypertension, and the iron release can cause liver damage. Additionally, one can see clinical evidence of nitric oxide scavenging as a result of demonstration of smooth muscle dystonias, and these can present as symptoms of dyspnea, dysphagia, and a majority of men with PNH will demonstrate erectile dysfunction. Patients can also present with sort of idiosyncratic abdominal pain and chest pain. Activation of the membrane attack complex at the surface of platelets and the potent inflammatory effects of C5a can directly activate platelets and cause platelet membrane blebbing, as well as leukocyte activation, which can directly activate the final common pathways of coagulation. And in the concert of increased cytokine release from neutrophils and activated leukocytes, one can see very marked increased risk for thrombosis. And indeed, thrombotic events are a common feature of this disease process. A majority of patients with PNH will also complain of fatigue, and this is for myriad factors, but also due to the free release of hemoglobin in circulation and the scavenged nitric oxide. Treatment of PNH has largely focused on inhibition of C5, the late activation of complement as described so eloquently by Dr. Weitz. C5 inhibition in PNH has been demonstrated to reduce hemolysis, decrease anemia, and decrease red cell transfusion dependence. We can see improvement of platelets in some patients because indeed the platelets are no longer being targeted by terminal complement activation. One can see decreased markers of thrombosis, improved pregnancy outcome, and indeed no worsening of side effects over time. The canonical C5 inhibitor is eculizumab. This drug was initially developed and tested in the TRIUMPH and SHEPHERD studies you can see here. Treatment with eculizumab resulted in improvements in fatigue and improvement in hemoglobin. And long-term treatment with eculizumab has resulted, as you can see here, in a substantial change in life expectancy for patients with PNH. On the left side, you can see actuarial survival from the time of PNH diagnosis in 80 patients in the pre-eculizumab era. And you can see here that such patients often had substantially decreased overall survival. On the right, you can see a later follow-up of a separate cohort of patients compared with age and sex-matched healthy controls. And what you can see here is in the post-eculizumab era, relative normalization of survival within this population, suggesting the profound importance of C5 inhibition or of complement inhibition in patients with PNH. Despite the efficacy of C5 inhibition with eculizumab, there were issues with this drug, particularly issues of breakthrough hemolysis. And these can result from a variety of different causes, including intrinsic resistance, which was described as a rare C5 variant occurring predominantly in an Asian population. We can also see insufficient dosing. Eculizumab is dosed with flat dosing, irrespective of weight and size. And so some people had intrinsically higher clearance of eculizumab, and some people were underdosed relative to size. And this insufficient dosing could be identified in patients who had normal day 8 LDH levels, but then LDH levels increased by day 15, suggesting breakthrough hemolysis at the end of the dosing interval. One could also see increased chronic complement activation, and this can be identified through evidence of high CH50 troughs. CH50 should be completely blocked in patients on effective complement inhibitor therapy. And some patients have increased chronic complement due to chronic infections or occult complement activating conditions. We can also see breakthrough hemolysis in the context of triggering events, things like surgery, infection, and pregnancy, which can increase the baseline production of complement. And we can see extravascular hemolysis, which we'll touch on in a moment. Management strategies that have been heretofore effective for patients with evidence of breakthrough hemolysis include things like increasing the dosing frequency, which is described in the package insert for use of eculizumab, decreasing the interval to 10 or 12 days, or increasing the dose, which is somewhat more convenient, giving it every 14 days. The alternative is to use an alternative therapy for C5 variants or for those with other forms of breakthrough. So at this point, I'll transition over to Dr. Weitz.
So as you've heard, ravulizumab was approved for patients with PNH and does have an extended half-life, can be given every 7 to 8 weeks per the package insert, and does seem to be non-inferior to eculizumab. There are a host of biosimilars that are still in development, C5 biosimilars, and then there are several other agents that affect the alternative pathway, including the C3 inhibitor, pegcetacoplan, which was recently approved, small molecule C5 receptor blockade, and then factor D and factor B inhibitors, which we'll talk about in a minute.
So let's go back to our case. Our patient was diagnosed with clinical PNH. He was vaccinated. And on eculizumab therapy, his creatinine normalized to 1.1. His hemoglobin remained about 10.8. He returns to see us complaining that eculizumab represents a substantial burden on him because he has to come every 2 weeks. And he's planning to start college. And so at this point, the decision is made to transition him to a longer acting C5 inhibitor, which is now dosed every 8 weeks. And he becomes very happy on this, and his creatinine remains normal and his hemoglobin remains in the 10 to 11 gram range. Ravulizumab is, like eculizumab, a humanized mouse monoclonal antibody that targets C5. Ravulizumab is distinct from eculizumab in that the FCR region has been modified to result in increased recycling back to the cell surface. So it has less high affinity to the binding within the clathrin-coated pit, and is so recycled to the cell surface, allowing longer half-life for this drug. The business end of the molecule that binds C5 is unchanged from the parent drug, eculizumab. Clinical studies using ravulizumab demonstrated non-inferiority to eculizumab, and you can see here that in terms of transfusion avoidance, LDH normalization, FACIT fatigue score, and breakthrough hemolysis, ravulizumab is essentially identical to eculizumab, non-inferior in this study. Thus, many people have transitioned their patients from eculizumab, the parent drug dosed every 2 weeks, to ravulizumab, the second generation drug, which is dosed every 8 weeks. Studies have demonstrated superior suppression of C5 levels using ravulizumab compared to eculizumab, and you can see here in this longitudinal measurement study in which C5 levels were measured over time in patients on RAV versus ECU, that those patients on eculizumab appeared to have more breakthrough events associated with increased levels of C5, presumably due to complement activating events or dosing breakthrough. Rates of breakthrough were higher clinically with ECU versus ravulizumab here, although rates of breakthrough are low with both drugs. So here's our patient. 4 years later, he remains on ravulizumab. His hemoglobin is between 10 and 11 grams, but he's noted to have persistent hyperbilirubinemia with bilirubins ranging between 4 and 9, and retic counts that remain elevated in the 140 to 160 range. The remainder of his counts are normal. So why does this patient have ongoing hemolysis, although clinically relatively insignificant? Residual hemolysis in PNH patients on anti-C5 therapy can be due to either breakthrough events or extravascular hemolysis due to deposition of activated C5 on the surface of red cells. Intravascular hemolysis events usually occur in the context of some sort of complement activating condition. So if the patient has a gastroenteritis or an infection, or they get sick or they have a surgical procedure, breakthrough hemolysis events can happen. By contrast, like in our patient RJ, one can have evidence of chronic ongoing extravascular hemolysis, and this is usually mediated by C3 deposition on the surface of red cells as delineated here in this slide. Hemolysis mediated by C3 deposition can be overcome as by targeting C3, and indeed, recently we have had the approval of the drug pegcetacoplan, and there were several studies, initially the phase 1 A and B studies, which demonstrated that if you take patients who are on chronic C5 inhibitor therapy and you switch them to C3 inhibitor therapy, you can see improvements in hemoglobin, decreases in bilirubin, decreases in LDH, and decreases in reticulocyte count. And based on these kinds of data, the FDA approved pegcetacoplan, a terminal complement inhibitor, in April of 2021. The Pegasus phase 3 study allowed patients who were on eculizumab at the time to receive a run-in period where they received both drugs together. And all the patients who were receiving both drugs were noted to have an increase in their hemoglobin. And then patients were randomized to either remain on pegcetacoplan or to transition back to single-agent eculizumab. And what you can see here is the improvement in hemoglobin associated with treatment with a C3 inhibitor compared with the C5 inhibitor. And this was sustained. So this Pegasus study demonstrated the safety of terminal complement inhibition with C3 inhibitors. Breakthrough hemolysis events did occur in 13 patients, 9 on the ecu arm and 4 on the pegcetacoplan arm. 3 patients in the pegcetacoplan arm DC'd treatment due to treatment emergent adverse events of hemolysis, and 1 serious adverse event. Injection site reactions with pegcetacoplan, which is parenthetically dosed subcutaneously twice a week as a relatively large volume injection, usually 20 mils, were the most common reaction. Most of these were relatively mild and they did not lead to changes in dose or study discontinuation. And there was some diarrhea reported on this study, one episode of moderate diarrhea. PNH patients with persistent anemia on eculizumab can be transitioned to pegcetacoplan, and pegcetacoplan was deemed superior to eculizumab in terms of improvements in hemoglobin and decreased transfusion requirements. Adverse events were predominantly related to the injection site reaction and diarrhea, and in patients on eculizumab who have persistent anemia, particularly those who are symptomatic, more proximal complement inhibition with pegcetacoplan can improve disease control versus eculizumab. There have been no overt thrombotic events on this agent as yet. I will parenthetically note that there are some pretty robust breakthrough hemolytic events that I have seen in my patients in the context of complement activating conditions. And in my experience, this has been associated with patients who have occult inflammatory conditions. In one case, a patient with substantial chronic urinary infection in the context of a BK virus infection that was unrecognized. Dr. Weitz will now talk about additional complement inhibitors.
So pegcetacoplan was the first new or novel drug available for treatment of PNH. But there are a host of other agents that are in clinical trials. And these include other alternative pathway inhibitors, including an oral factor B inhibitor, iptacopan, danicopan, which is an oral factor D inhibitor, and BCX9930, another oral factor D inhibitor. There are also, there's also another monoclonal to C5, crovolumab, pozelimab, which is an additional C5 monoclonal antibody, and zilucoplan, which is a suppressing mRNA. The data from iptacopan, the phase 3 trials, are in the process of being completed and analyzed, but this is from previous studies. You can see that the oral factor B inhibitor is very effective at reducing the LDH and improving the hemoglobin. The iptacopan is dosed twice daily, and initially it was overlapped, and there is some current evidence that the eculizumab can be discontinued and the iptacopan can be given as monotherapy. There were no treatment discontinuations or serious adverse events noted. Other alternative pathway inhibitors include factor D inhibitors, including danicopan, as I mentioned, and BCX9930. In the phase 2 study of eculizumab versus eculizumab plus danicopan, you can see that in the danicopan arm, there was a substantial increase in the hemoglobin at 12 weeks, which continued to improve at 24 weeks. The fatigue scores also improved. The LDHs remained stable, and the bilirubins also improved. Indirect bili improved, and there was no change in the PNH clone size. Reticulocyte counts also decreased as the hemoglobin increased. So there are additional alternative pathway inhibitors, including BCX9930, which has been used as monotherapy in its phase 2 trials. It is entering phase 3 trials now, although there is no data at this point. So all of these represent opportunities for the patients. BCX9930 and danicopan are oral factor D inhibitors. Iptacopan, the oral factor B inhibitor, all appear to be effective in decreasing intravascular hemolysis in these patients. Their effect on other aspects of PNH remains to be determined, including thrombosis and markers of hemostatic activation. So complement inhibitors of C5 and C3 are available for clinical practice now. Long-term proximal C5 inhibition improves survival, limits organ damage. Patients with breakthrough hemolysis can benefit from a switch to C3 inhibitor therapy with improved hemoglobin and decreased transfusion dependence. And the novel inhibitors of complement through the alternative pathway are in development, and those include inhibitors of factor B, factor D, and which appear to have efficacy in PNH.